stories, Iran's foreign minister says the positive developments in JCPOA revival talks in Vienna do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. The UK Prime Minister suffers another blow in his battle for survival as one of his most loyal supporters says Johnson's removal is now inevitable. Jab or no jab, opponents and supporters of COVID vaccine mandates hold rallies in several cities across Canada. Our top story this hour, Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a telephone call with European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. He says the 2015 deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits in a reliable and sustainable manner. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories have been engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the accord. In the latest development, Washington has announced the restoration of a sanction waiver, but Iran's officials say the U.S. should show its goodwill in practice and by removing all its anti-Iran sanctions. Earlier, we reached out to history professor and political commentator David Yavuvian to get his comments on these developments. He says the JCPOA would only revive if it benefits Iran economically.
Amir Abdullahian is, of course, stating and repeating the obvious, that it's only going to be verifiable and sustainable sanctions relief that brings Iran fully back into accordance with the JCPOA if it can be saved. And the State Department release is very specific. It says that this is not a quid pro quo, that this does not necessarily benefit Iran, but it explicitly says that even if the JCPOA is not returned to fully, if both sides don't return to full implementation, and I'm closely paraphrasing here, it will still assist us in our non-proliferation efforts. Therefore, this potentially benefits the United States if the JCPOA is not returned to. It does indeed facilitate the ultimate return to full implementation by both sides, and therefore, to Amir Abdullahian's point, it's still moving in the right direction, but no, indeed, this doesn't provide Iran with anything, and what Iran is looking for is verifiable, sustainable sanctions relief. Even a full year after Donald Trump pulled out in May of 2018, Iran maintained all of its commitments under the agreement, despite the fact that it never achieved the goal of the agreement for Iran in the first place, which was sanctions relief. So thankfully, I think we're at a point where the Iranian negotiating team, quite seasoned, and quite skilled regarding the various tricks and shenanigans, if you will, that the United States is going to try to pull off here. We're either going to return to a JCPOA that benefits Iran economically, or we will not be returning to the agreement.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says all regional problems and issues can be solved if foreign powers stop their interventions. In a phone call with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi, the Iranian president said the problems in the region are due to the excessive demands of the United States. He added that if the Americans are literally expelled from West Asia, regional countries will fully establish peace, stability, and security by cooperating with one another. Raisi also said Iraq has a significant position in Iran's policy with regard to the development of neighborly and regional relations. Al-Qadhimi also welcomed Iran's approach in the comprehensive expansion of neighborly and regional interactions. He expressed hope for deeper bilateral ties and cooperation. Saudi warplanes carry out over 30 fresh airstrikes across Yemen. The provinces of Sana'a, Sa'ada, Jawf, and Hadja have been the targets. There was no immediate word on the possible casualties. Saudi Arabia and its allies have ramped up their aggression against Yemen in recent weeks. The Yemeni army is responding with cross-border retaliatory strikes inside the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. It says it'll continue its operations until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war comes to an end. The U.S. administration has changed hands between Democrats and Republicans since the outbreak of the Saudi-led war in Yemen in 2015. But no matter which government holds the reins, the U.S. sticks to the same policies. 7 years on, the U.S. continues to provide the coalition states with unwavering military and diplomatic support, making itself complicit in Yemen's war crimes. In this report, we'll review how three U.S. administrations missed their chances to end one of the world's bloodiest wars.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop this slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end this slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it'll give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Controversy around the British Prime Minister, Mr. Johnson, thickens as one of his most loyal backbench supporter says his removal is now inevitable. Former Tory lawmaker Sir Charles Walker has implored the Prime Minister to step down in the national interest. This comes as Johnson faces mounting pressure to resign over his handling of Downing Street's lockdown parties. The so-called Partygate scandal has caused several MPs to turn their backs on the Premier and prompted five senior number 10 aides to resign. Johnson could face a vote of no confidence, that is, in his leadership. If 54 of his 360 Conservative lawmakers submit a letter of no confidence, so far, a dozen MPs have publicly turned on the Prime Minister and submitted such a letter. Elsewhere, Canadian cities, including the capital, Ottawa, have become a scene of demonstrations against vaccine mandates, raising fears of clashes with counter-protesters. The so-called Freedom Convoy began as a movement against the vaccine requirement for cross-border truckers. The movement soon morphed into protests against public health measures and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government. Some cities, including the financial hub Toronto, have even faced disruptions with truckers blocking roads and shutting down several areas. Quebec was also rocked by similar protests. The organizers say they expect their numbers to swell into the tens of thousands. Police say the well-organized blockades rely partly on funding from sympathizers in the United States. The U.S. is further fanning the flames of tensions in East Europe by deploying troops in the region. We discussed that matter with our guests in our news review program. Take a listen.
The United States is deploying additional troops to Europe as a standoff between the West and Russia intensifies over Ukraine. First batch of American soldiers landed in Poland shortly after the arrival of senior U.S. commanders. Polish Army spokesman says the bulk of a contingent of 1,700 U.S. soldiers will soon be coming. President Joe Biden is sending nearly 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania. Washington says the move is aimed at shielding Eastern Europe in the face of a potential spillover from the Ukraine crisis. U.S. and its allies have accused Russia of amassing over 100,000 troops along its border with Ukraine in preparation for an invasion. Moscow denies that and is strongly opposed to increased military activity by the U.S. and NATO near its borders. Joining us now is Mr. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg, Virginia. Hope you're doing well, sir. Welcome. And your initial thoughts on Russia wants just a few security guarantees, and this whole thing can go away. The U.S. and the West are not giving it, not even entertaining any of those security guarantees. Once again, we're seeing this my way or highway policy when it comes to an adversary by the West. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you're right, and the U.S. and the British and NATO continue their provocations such as these troops, but the world changed dramatically yesterday when Putin and Xi Jinping issued a joint statement after their meeting in Beijing, which is literally the declaration of a new paradigm for mankind, not just for Russia and China, but for the world. And to understand how profound this statement was, the Daily Telegraph, which is perhaps the leading voice of the British Empire in the city of London, headlined an article today. I'll read it. Russia and China rise from their knees to challenge U.S. dominance. It says, the Russia and China are asserting the arrival of a new geopolitical era. I would actually add that this is an anti-geopolitical era. Geopolitics is the British imperial game of zero sum. And in fact, as you know, I'm sure, Russia and China are focused on this Chinese idea of win-win, of a common future for mankind. The freakout, and it is a freakout by the Daily Telegraph, goes on to say that these two nations, after decades of humiliation have risen from their knees and will now upend the inequitable post-Cold War world order. Now, you might say this is good to hear some truth from the British for a change, but the fact is they're basically declaring that they can no longer hope to prevent Russia and China from collaborating and from collaborating on the development of the Third World through the Belt and Road. And the implication is that they have no choice but to go to war. That reality, I think you should know. Michael Bloomberg, one of the leading spokesmen for Wall Street and for the Green New Deal and the whole Malthusian genocide being imposed by the Western banking systems, yesterday posted a headline on Bloomberg News that said, Russia invades Ukraine. This lie, this provocation in the midst of the hysteria that's been developed over these last months, daily reports that Russia's going to invade Ukraine imminently, even though Russia denies it, and in fact, even the Zelensky regime in Ukraine denies it, yet it continues day after day after day. And then Michael Bloomberg posts a headline saying Russia invades Ukraine. This is precisely what the Schiller Institute and the LaRouche organization have warned could lead the West into what could be sleepwalking into thermonuclear World War III. Mr. Peshkov, the spokesman for Putin, basically said the same thing.
It's always a pleasure, Mr. Mike Billington from Leesburg, Virginia. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. The mother of an African-American man killed by the U.S. police during a raid on his apartment has called for the officer at fault to be prosecuted.
At the end of the day, I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son
yes.
to be prosecuted
yes.
and fired.
Yes.
Locke's parents describe their son as a talented musician, a beloved member of his community, and a law-abiding citizen. The incident occurred in the early hours of Wednesday. Footage released by the police shows an officer using a key to unlock the door, and then a group of officers enter while shouting, "Police! Search warrant!" Locke, who was on a couch, starts to rise from beneath a blanket with a gun in his hand. When police fired, a total time between the officer's entrance and the shots fired was less than 10 seconds. The attorney of the Locke family has slammed the police conduct and said they gave the victim no chance. And that's it with international news.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a backlash from Conservative MPs after allies briefed that the Prime Minister had won over his party, as splits appear in the One Nation group of Tory centrists about how to proceed. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson Faces Backlash from Angry Tory MPs Over Party Scandal. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a backlash from Conservative MPs after allies briefed that the Prime Minister had won over his party, as splits appear in the One Nation group of Tory centrists about how to proceed. On Tuesday, 1st of February, the veteran MP Peter Aldous said he had submitted a letter of no confidence, and MP Tom Hunt criticised the cack-handed backers of the Prime Minister, though stopped short of saying he should resign. Gary Streeter, the MP for South West Devon, also declined to say he had confidence in the Prime Minister. It is understood Boris Johnson saw at least four former ministers late on Monday night, after at least three others told him their support was either lost or conditional on Sue Gray's final report on Downing Street's lockdown breaches, now being investigated by police. Senior Conservative MP Peter Aldous became the latest MP to say he had written a letter of no confidence in Boris Johnson. After a great deal of soul-searching, I have reached the conclusion that the Prime Minister should resign, Aldous tweeted. I have never taken such action before and had hoped that I would not be put in such an invidious position. Whilst I am conscious that others will disagree with me, I believe that this is in the best interest of the country, the government and the Conservative Party. Charles Walker, the vice-chair of the 1922 Committee of Tory Backbenchers, added his voice to the mix, saying he would applaud Johnson for resigning. I think there's so much grief and pain out there that if he was to say that he would resign, that would show great courage, he told Channel 4 News. I would applaud him for doing that, but that is his decision. Elliot Colburn, MP for Carshalton and Wallington, also revealed to a constituent that his patience has now snapped with Boris Johnson and the Partygate scandal, in a hint that he could be among those to have put in a letter. If I were the Prime Minister, I'd be considering my position, Elliot Colburn said. Gary Streeter, the MP for South West Devon, said it was not true the Prime Minister's meeting with MPs had been well received on Monday evening. This one is not over yet, he told BBC Radio Devon. It has got legs. A lot of us are thinking very seriously about what we should do about it. It's a serious matter, of course, to express no confidence in a Prime Minister. I'm reflecting, and certainly over the next couple of days, we'll make a decision. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson's critics have admitted there was no plan and no coordination among those who believed the Prime Minister should go. One senior MP, who has been publicly critical of Johnson, said they had been aghast at colleagues' response to the Prime Minister's private meeting with his MPs on Monday night. The Tory party's reputation for ruthlessness is a complete lie. It's actually never been true, and we're seeing it happening before our eyes, the MP said. One former minister who said they were among a number of colleagues prepared to move as a collective after the Sue Gray report described it as a deeply unwelcome delay, but said they still held the view that a no-confidence vote would have a greater chance of success once the full evidence had been disclosed. But another former cabinet minister who has seen Boris Johnson said The idea of a leadership contest was filling people with horror about the damage that in itself could do to the party. We would be on our fourth prime minister. What does that say about the party? For better or for worse, we did throw our lot in with him and we won a big majority. But the MP said that would change if Johnson was fined by the Metropolitan Police. He's not out of the woods, no. He'd be very foolish to have a mission accomplished banner. At the point where he has committed a criminal offence, of course that changes things, and it depends how bad is the final Sue Gray report. Among those who have expressed anger and frustration are some of the more critical 2019 MPs, who have privately told more experienced colleagues they feel betrayed. Tom Hunt has said the limited findings made in Sue Gray's update were not acceptable, excusable, or defensible, but stopped short of saying it meant he had submitted a letter of no confidence. The MP for Ipswich said some of the interventions by Boris Johnson's allies had been so cack-handed that the best way they could be of assistance to the Prime Minister would be to disable all their social media platforms and cease carrying out media interviews. Silence would be preferable, he said. Tom Hunt, the MP for Ipswich, said it was not the time to depose the Prime Minister, but that a line could not be drawn under the saga until the full report by senior civil servant Sue Gray was published.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and heartfelt condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace upon him, the 10th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Let us listen to a thought-provoking aphorism from him. Allah has made this world for trial and tribulation, while he has made afterlife for receiving the result. He has also made the misfortunes of this world because of gaining the rewards of the hereafter, and made the rewards of the life to come as the compensation for the misfortunes of this world.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akberi. Well, today in this session, inshallah, we are going to discuss about self-knowledge, or discuss ma'rifat al-nafs, which is an important topic. Of course, self-knowledge is a prelude to living a better life. It is so critical and so important to know ourselves, our capacities, our position in relation to Allah, and finally, the goal for which we have been created. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, when discussing a topic such as this, it is perhaps best to begin with its definition and assessment of its importance. Of course, there is no doubt as to the fact that self-knowledge is highly critical and highly important. But of course, if we study this topic from the perspective of the Holy Quran and from the perspective of the riwayat, of course, then we will further understand the importance of self-knowledge. Let us then begin by defining some terms. In Arabic, self-knowledge is called ma'rifat al-nafs. Now, what is ma'rifat al-nafs or self-knowledge? It is knowledge about us. But what kind of knowledge is it? It's not the kind that has to do with knowing our names or our father name or the place and date of our birth. Of course, this has nothing to do with self-knowledge, because it's just a kind of nominal knowledge. It's not real knowledge. Now, self-knowledge deals with another aspect of our being. It is not related to our physical senses. Of course, it is not related to our names and to our, you know, history, and rather it deals with the spiritual dimension of our lives. When we speak of the different dimensions of the spirit in our being, we should not forget that the human being is fundamentally and essentially different from other beings. Man is a rational agent and other beings are not rational. That's what, you know, differentiates, or that's what makes the difference between human beings and other animals or other species. And although we are tied to the animal world, we are living in this animal world, and we are very much connected with this world in many ways, of course, we wish to focus on that which separates us from animals and is not found in them. Now, we wish to focus on that aspect of the human existence which clearly distinguishes him from other species, other animals, and other creatures. To understand why this topic is of such importance, perhaps it helps us to quote a few verses from the Holy Quran and from Hadith on the subject. There are many verses in the Quran which point point to the importance of self-knowledge. One of those verses is found in Surah Al-Hashr, where the Quran says, "And be not like those who forgot Allah, so He made them forget their own souls. It is that are the transgressors." And here the Lord, and of course in this verse of the Holy Quran, and the Lord, the Almighty, is saying that forgetting Allah, the Almighty, causes us to forget ourselves in turn. And ultimately, it leads us to become transgressors in the eye of Allah. It definitely leads us to transgression. If you forget God, you will end up becoming a transgressor. That is it. Because the Quran says, "Ulaika humul fasiqun," and those who forget God and then God makes them forget themselves, they will be transgressors in the eye of Allah. And there is a tradition that makes a similar point, of course, to that of this verse, but looks at the matter from another angle. Now, this tradition is a very famous one, and it is difficult to find a book on ethics which has not quoted it. Almost every book that you study about self-knowledge, this hadith or this narration is there, and it is so well known. The hadith says, "Man arafa nafsah faqad arafa rabbah." He who truly knows himself has known his Lord. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oasis. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the Western, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome to your program For a Better Life. We are discussing Ma'rifat al-Nafs, self-knowledge. Self-knowledge implies knowledge about Lord as well. In the other word, that these two knowledges are somehow interwoven or intertwined with each other. If a self-knowledge is achieved, then obviously knowledge of the Lord, knowledge of God is also achieved. I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, that knowledge of the self, knowledge of oneself, one's capacities, one's abilities, serves as a prelude, as an important step towards living a better life. Because unless you know yourself, and unless you know your capacities and your goals and the purpose for which you are created, then you will not be able to move to achieve those goals and live a better life. So awareness of oneself leads to awareness of the Lord. That's what the hadith says. And likewise, one who is oblivious of the Lord is oblivious of himself. So you can say these two kinds of knowledge are concurrent. They are part and parcel of each other, and they cannot be separated from each other. And there's no doubt as to the fact that if one is determined to learn about one's Lord, then the best way to accomplish this task is to learn about oneself. Now, as I said, there are other verses, there are also traditions, but there is also another verse which I would like to mention you, and I would like to bring it to your attention. And the Quran says in Surah Al-Maidah, "Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu alaykum anfusakum la yadhurrukum man dhalla idha ihtadaytum ila Allahi marja'ukum jami'an fayunabbi'ukum bima kuntum ta'malun." O you who believe, take care of yourselves. Alaykum anfusakum. La yadhurrukum man dhalla idha ihtadaytum. He who errs cannot hurt you when you are on the right path. So, verse 105 of chapter 5, chapter Al-Ma'idah. Now, this is one of those verses which also clearly points to self-knowledge. And of course, in this verse, Allah is telling us to take care of ourselves, to pay attention to ourselves, and to be heedful of ourselves, and that we must be careful about the well-being of our spirits, and that we must be aware of the diseases of our souls or our nafs, because that the nafs is so important. And of course, the word nafs has been translated in different ways. Some people have translated as soul, and some have translated as self, and of course some have used the word nafs to convey the message. And of course, soul is slightly different from the word nafs, so we have problem making use of the proper English term. Now, of course, when it comes to different levels of nafs, we have different levels. Inshallah, maybe in the following episode, we will discuss that. To make a long story short, of course, we have to understand that awareness of our nafs, knowledge of ourself, and knowledge of the diseases of our souls and how to cure them is very much important. And God Almighty, Allah tells us that we should pay attention to our duties and those obligations that Allah has prescribed on us and that He has made it incumbent upon us. So, inshallah, we will further discuss the subject of nafs in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land He knows. Every shade of pearl, every closed hand He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share He knows.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Over the past few years, people have become more aware of the detrimental effect of littering on the environment. Now, a Mexican kayaker has decided to launch his own campaign to save the environment. 66-year-old Omar Menchaca usually paddles his single-seater kayak through the floating gardens of the Xochimilco canals near the Mexico City, collecting garbage left by visitors. Menchaca says he normally does the cleanup in the early morning before tourists arrive to the site, using bare hands to pick up debris. The former athlete who did his training for the competitions in the canals says over time he found that the waterways were littered with rubbish.
I knew this place, and I came to this place because here I did my training for my competitions. Unfortunately, over time, I began to notice that some canals were full of rubbish. Xochimilco is very important to me. Xochimilco is considered a World Heritage Site. It does not belong to Mexicans. It is the heritage of all human beings.
Menchaca believes that if people ignore their environment, soon there will be a time when they have nothing to enjoy. He hopes that his efforts to protect wetlands make a small difference and preserve the place for future generations. The Xochimilco site is home to endemic species, including the critically endangered ones, and is usually visited by thousands of people on weekends. The 15th edition of the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up. As Salman Khojouri reports, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. Ismo.
The 15th Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up its work. The four-day event brought together representatives of different sectors active in tourism and handicrafts fields, including airlines, cruise lines, hotels, museums, travel agencies, insurance services, travel and tourism facilities, and masters of handicrafts. The exhibition is considered as the most appropriate platform to optimize face-to-face communication among the involved industries. From a tourism point of view, Iran enjoys two important and unique features. The first one is Iran's exceptional geographical location among countries in the world, and the second feature is its tourism attractions of historical, cultural, natural, pilgrimage, adventurous, and other sorts.
Qalamzani, or metal engraving, is an Iranian ancient metalwork art.
It is engraved by chisels and hammers on different metals such as gold, silver, copper, brass, and some alloys. Its origin dates back to almost 7,000 years ago. It is the art of carving superb designs on various metals. The artistic work of this course made by the artists are the glorious and undeniable indication of previous metal work of Iran, and in particular Isfahan.
I'm from Hormozgan province, south of Iran. Handicrafts have always been an integral part of Hormozgan province due to the rich culture and special customs of the region. Hormozgan province embraces scenic islands, among which Kish, Hormoz, Hengam, and Qeshm are the most beautiful ones and top tourist destinations in southern Iran.
Iran has globally registered 11 cities and 3 villages under their native handicrafts during the past 6 years, making the country a world leader in registering local productions. There are totally 602 handicrafts fields identified on a global scale. 299 fields are special to Iran, from which 199 fields are in the central Iranian province of Isfahan.
With 14 entries, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council, as China with 7 entries, Chile with 4 entries, and India with 3 ones come next. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcome the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep the social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new Lunar Year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world, as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is, and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
And many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fears surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately a million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 1st. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, a symbol of strength and power. The National Zoo in Washington is now home to a new quill-covered resident, the second offspring of a porcupine family. Zoo staff reported the birth of the porcupet earlier this month during a snowstorm. They say they are awaiting a DNA analysis to reveal more information about the baby porcupine. Its brother is now 4 years old. The two siblings are the fourth generation of this family to live in the zoo's mammal house. These animals are born with the ability to climb and look almost identical until they are 6 months old. Natives of South America, these creatures are one of the 18 porcupine species that exist in the world today. House in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with a novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
To congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
In the limelight.
According to recent revelations, former US President Donald Trump thinks his own Vice President Mike Pence should be investigated by the committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol for failing to reject Electoral College results on that fateful day. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled "Trump tore up records turned over to House Capitol Attack Committee." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The National Archives said some of the White House records turned over to the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack were ripped up by former US President Donald Trump. It also emerged on Tuesday, 1st of February, that the former president thinks his own Vice President Mike Pence should be investigated by the committee for failing to reject Electoral College results on that fateful day. Documents obtained by the 6th of January panel include diaries, schedules, handwritten notes, speeches, and remarks. The Supreme Court rejected Donald Trump's attempt to stop the National Archives turning them over to Congress. In a statement, the National Archives said, "Some of the Trump presidential records received by the National Archives and Records Administration included paper records that had been torn up by former President Donald Trump." The National Archives added, "These were turned over to the National Archives at the end of the Trump administration, along with a number of torn-up records that had not been reconstructed by the White House."